This is not a drill. This is not a drill. General quarters. General quarters. All hands on your battle station.
Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime. And welcome aboard, everybody. I am the aforementioned Sal, along with my co-host, the ever-genial Eagle One of Eagle Speak. Appreciate y'all joining us today for another edition of Midrats. And if you are with our esteemed cohort live, if you're so inclined, scroll down to the bottom of the show page. That's where you will find a link to the chat room and where you can find some of the usual suspects today. Not only is our guest there, but we also have Chris Raleigh and Claude Barabay. So if you'd like to join them in the chat room and share your observations during the course of the show, that's the perfect place to be. But also, if there are some questions that you would like for us to ask our guest during the course of the show, you can put that in there too. And if we don't steal it directly, it will probably flavor questions we ask later on. And as always, my altar call on Midrats, if life pulls you away before the show is over with, or you haven't joined us in a while and you want to catch up on some of the shows you missed, remember, you can go over to iTunes, Spreaker, whatever podcast aggregator you use. Go ahead and subscribe to the free podcast, and Midrats will be ready for you when you have a more convenient time in your busy schedule to listen to us. And today we're going to look at a few questions that should be familiar and well within the wheelhouse of Midrats listeners, but also if we have some new listeners out there that we get, thankfully, on a regular basis, who are trying to get up to speed on national security and specifically maritime issues. These are some questions I think are going to be really helpful for you to start to see some of the nuance and the depth in some of the issues that those who concern themselves in this area look at on a regular basis. We're going to look at how we best secure this nation's and our allies' security and interest at sea, and why Americans should look to the sea. And this security that we've enjoyed in the last three quarters of a century, have we taken them for granted as something that's gifted to us in perpetuity? And is this an assumption that is in danger? We're going to look at some of the steps that need to be taken to help make sure that this legacy continues, and some of the things that might be happening that could change what most people assume to be the natural order of things. And our guest to discuss this and other related topics today is coming back to Midrats for another visit, Dr. Jerry Hendricks, Captain, United States Navy, retired. And we're going to be using as a baseline for our conversation his upcoming book that should be ready for you to grab from Amazon sooner more than later, titled To Provide and Maintain a Navy, Why Naval Primacy is America's First and Best Strategy. Jerry, it's great to have you on board again. Welcome back to Midrats.
It's great to be back, Sal, and Eagle One. Pleasure to talk to you about what I think is a really crucial strategic issue confronting our country.
And Jerry, congratulations, and I really appreciate the read-ahead copy as well. And it's when I was about, I don't know, a third of the way through the book, I realized this is the navalist version of the pocket constitution. And if we lived in my perfect little world, inside the Washington, D.C. commuting radius, all navalists out there will find their inner 1970s Hare Krishna, buy a case, and head on over to the Acela Lounge at Union Station, Reagan National, BWI, and Dulles, and just start handing this out to people who are about to take a plane or a train trip. Because at a little more than 100 pages, this is a I need something to read for the next few hours or a beautiful afternoon read. It's compact, but it's not thick. It makes an argument. It explains it. So congratulations on a very efficient job in the book. And just as a scene setter, let's look at, and I think you acknowledge this in the acknowledgments part at the end of the book, but besides the time that COVID-19 gave you to have a little bit of extra white space in your life, why now for this particular book and this particular topic, and why the title to provide and maintain a Navy?
All right. Well, let me take those in order. Why now is I think that we're really at the cusp of a real requirement to change our strategic direction. We've been talking for the better part of 4 years about great power competition, recognizing we're in a great power competition, and recognizing who are those competitors. But we haven't really gotten into the hard conversation of how are they competing and how will we be best situated to compete against them. Where are our strengths? Where are our weaknesses? When I had the chance to work for a couple of years in the Office of Net Assessment, one of the things that we always spoke about there was look for asymmetric advantage. Find out where your strengths are and the other guy's weaknesses are. Also be aware of where your weaknesses are and where his strengths are. Make sure you're playing your strength against his weakness. And this was one of the things that as I looked at it, that we for far, far too long now, for the better part of 70 years, have tried to be all things to all people. We have tried to be a traditional continental land power, and we've gotten engaged in overseas wars, Korea, Vietnam, Middle East, Yugoslavia, back to the Middle East, Afghanistan. And those wars, while important at the time, at least in the way that we view them, have also become strategic distractions to us. Now we're back in another great power competition in the way that we were during the Cold War, and we're still sort of shaking off that distraction, that little hangover that we've had from the last 20 years, and we need to get focused, and we need to get focused now, and we have to start talking about priorities. I sat down to write the book because I felt like, at least for myself, for most of the last 6-7 years since my retirement from active duty, I've been focused on arguing about numbers. And the numbers are important. 355 has been important. The administration's recent release of its 400-ship Navy plan for the next 30 years, that's an important number as well. There's an argument there. But we fail all too often to not answer the question of why do we need that number? Where am I going to use those ships? What types of ships are they in? What order? Where will that pressure be applied? What is the importance of influence versus war fighting? And sort of how does that figure out? I've tried to write articles over the last 6-7 years, and it hit me that I've written a little bit here and a little bit there, but I had never brought it all together. And the more I thought about it, I realized that the Navy's leadership and the Department of Defense has not brought it all together. Although we have things like National Security Strategy and the National Defense Strategy, we hadn't really articulated it in this way. We've all sort of talked about for the last couple of years that some of the things that we're doing so far as the 30-30 split are required by Goldwater-Nichols doesn't make sense. So why doesn't it make sense? And that's what I tried to do in this. And when I sat down to write, I realized I had a choice. I was either going to write an incredibly thick, in-depth book that really only true masters of the trade were going to be able to read and understand. And I've read those books, and I do understand them, but they're not transmittable. It's not something that can be easily taken in and digested by a broader audience. About 20 years ago, I read a book by Robert Kagan called Of Paradise and Power, which was only 108 pages long, and yet gave this really great description of the relationship between the United States and Europe. And I really admired that book, and I admired the way the author brought it forward. So when I sat down to do this book, I decided I wanted to write something similar, where I could bring together a coherent argument about the importance of naval power and naval strategy in American life, and try and present it in a way that can be read in a single afternoon, like you said, perhaps on a long airplane flight. And so that was my attempt. Now, as for the title, To Provide and Maintain a Navy, those of us sort of the Church of the Navy understand that that's from Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution, where it says the Congress shall, and it goes down through a long line of things that the Congress shall do. It gets to this point here, it says, to raise and support armies, but no appropriation of money that to that use shall be made for longer term than 2 years. And so Congress says you will raise and support armies, but in the very next line it says to provide and maintain a navy. The army was always viewed as a transitory service by the Constitution and by the Congress, but the navy was permanent because the Congress recognized that the nation was a sea power and that its naval arm must be provided for and maintained at all costs. And so that's sort of the genesis of the book.
Well, it's a very good short book. I read it almost like a legal brief. You've laid out the issues, why we need a Navy. You analyze the facts behind it, and then you present an assessment and a conclusion. Let's talk a little bit about why you what is the value? I mean, to go back to the fundamentals, and this is very fundamental. What is the function of our Navy and also our merchant marine that we seem to be lacking somewhat these days?
Well, I mean, this is something that, again, you know, I think it's important for us navalists to get out of our own small church and get out and talk to a broader public. Far too often, you know, we write our articles and we publish them in our own professional journals and we read them and we go, yep, that's good. But do we ever get that beyond that to the broader American audience? The answer is no. And this is something we have to do. So why do navies exist? Well, generally navies exist to protect sea lines of communication and commerce that flows between nations. And in a time of war, navies exist to prosecute the wartime aims of the nation that they belong to. But it's the peacetime role that really has driven the American Navy, especially after World War II. During the 19th century, it was Great Britain that maintained peace and security and international rules and norms on the high seas. But since the end of World War II, it's been the United States Navy. You know, we came out of World War II with some 6,000 ships. We very quickly got down to 1,000 ships. Actually, if you look at over the last 70 years and you do all the numbers, the average size of the American Navy is around 900 ships. The fact that we're down today to 295 really demonstrates how much we've cut over the most frequent past couple decades. And so one of the things I get into the book is sort of the description about why these navies exist. It's to protect the ideas of free trade and free navigation on the high seas, which a lot of the global commerce is based upon, the idea that the seas are free and that you can go take your products from the place where they can be most cheaply produced and then sold them someplace at a great distance away at a higher price and hence make a profit. Well, Navy's there to protect that sea line of communication. We've done this for so long, 70 years now, and we've been so good at it that everyone just assumes that the seas are safe. And the fact of the matter is that really in the last 20 years, we've started to see a slow crumbling of maritime security. We've seen the growth of piracy. We've begun to see people begin to press outward and make larger claims of territoriality over the world's oceans. And because the United States Navy has not been as large, it hasn't been able to be as present. And this has begun to cause the global system to begin to degrade and crumble.
And that global system, I think one of the advantages to this, and why when I got about a third of the way through the book, is when I thought of the Hare Krishnas, we need people handing this out to folks, is the book is roughly in two parts, almost exactly if you want to do a page count about it. The first half, you kind of build the historical precedent for the second half, which is, and it goes back to kind of what I said in the intro about people have assumptions that this is just the natural order of things. It's not the natural order of things. And you briefly touched on it in your answer to the previous question, is the fact that totalitarian societies and free societies look at the seas fundamentally different. Free trade to build wealth versus a resource to extract something from. And in a strange way, the system we have right now, and you know, flesh out a little bit how that happened, is the Dutch, thanks to their Reformation, their lack of a better phrase, their enlightenment of the Dutch Enlightenment. They helped in a large way that in their coastal artillery kind of define the modern understanding of the assumption of the free seas.
Yeah, so this is the thing that strikes me. And again, Eagle One, thank you for your comparison to a legal brief, because this all starts with a legal brief. There is a Dutch ship that's actually the Dutch capture a Portuguese ship and bring it back, and it's worth a lot when it's sold off. It's actually almost twice the size of the government's budget for the year is how much the ship is left. But they're sued in court, essentially an international court, over the value of that. And the Dutch hire a lawyer. His name is Hugo Grotius to represent them on this. Well, Grotius does an interesting trick, a legal trick. He ends up losing his client their case, where they have to surrender the value of the ship. But he also gains international acceptance of the idea that the seas are free. And he makes a natural law argument that in much the same way that an individual man can move between nations so long as he's conducting trade, then ships can move between nations conducting trade as well, because the seas lack even the most natural of barriers, where there's mountain passes or rivers that actually divide nations. The seas have no such characteristics. And so he makes this really elegant legal argument about the free sea, and this argument is encapsulated in a paper, a treatise of the time in 1609 called Mare Liberum, or the Free Sea. Now, what's interesting about that is simultaneously other nations are making the other argument. They're making the argument of the extension of vast areas of territoriality over the sea. And this is the Mare Clausum, or closed sea argument. In the end, the free sea wins, and it becomes the very basic. It's a foundational principle in the ideas of the Western Enlightenment. And really, when you think about the very concept of freedom and individual liberty, you know, where does that concept begin? How do you start to understand what those things are? And people would say, well, an individual is free like ships at sea are free. And so this is a foundational aspect of how we grew to have, you know, ideas about liberty and individual freedom. So it's important to understand it's foundational. It's important to understand that, because now that idea is viewed as a threat by nations such as Russia and China, which are authoritarian and have viewed the concept of free trade and free navigation and the transmittal of ideas around freedom that as a danger to themselves. Because if those ideas make it into their ports and then make it into their populations, then ideas like that can cause instability, domestic instability for them. And so they've always viewed most continental powers, especially imperial continental powers, have always viewed the sea somewhat skeptically, because it's a place that's a transmittal of ideas that undermine them. And so today we actually see that. China and Russia are the two countries that I highlight in this that are trying to do these extensions of territoriality over the sea, and that the idea that if I can extend my weapons range over the sea, then in fact I ought to be able to claim territoriality. So extended economic zones. The Chinese have made the argument that if they can weaponize their EEZs and they can actually carefully patrol them and police them, then in fact they take on more characteristics of sovereign territorial waters. And you see the Chinese making some of these arguments within their brief before the Hague Tribunal that did not go well. And Russia today is making such legal arguments with regard to the Northern Sea Route, where, one, they're amending their baselines, territorial baselines, but they're also stating that because of the ice up there that there's a pilotage fee and that they want to make a claim. And I think it's under Article 235 of the U.N. Charter, not the U.N. Charter, of the Law of the Sea, that they're wanting to call the Northern Sea Route internal waters, as if it was the Mississippi River. And so this is part of the closed sea argument that actually goes back to the 17th century, that where they talked about a two-cannon shot rule, or the cannon shot rule, that you could claim territorial seas out to the range of how far you could cover with a cannon. And again, China is looking at it and say, I've got these DF-21s, I've got 26s. you know, can I not claim territorial if I can keep you from coming into it or police the objects that move through it? And so these are some of the arguments that we're fighting with naval presence. Every time we send a destroyer or a new frigate through some of these contested waters, we're actually pushing back. We're demonstrating the seas are free and that they're international waters, they're high seas, and we're upholding that part of our enlightenment. But if we allow the Navy to fall so that we cannot maintain those presence missions, if we don't have enough ships, then, you know, we lose, they gain. And that's one of the problems we face today.
Yeah, having gone on a couple of FONUPs myself, it's an interesting problem because we don't have enough ships. You've mentioned this in the book. Talk about that a little bit. How, you know, what can we not do with 279 ships, whatever it is that we could do when we had 700 or 800 ships?
All right. Well, I mean, think about this. We made all these presence requirements. So the regional combatant commanders came up and said, I need a ship to be here. And let's just say it's up north of Norway, and I'd like to have this presence where a ship comes by and does a freedom of navigation operation or a, you know, some sort of an innocent passage or one of the other, you know, numerous missions or exercises we do with allies. When the Navy was large, when it was 900 ships, 700, you know, 500, 600, it was very easy for the people who wrote our ship schedules in the various different fleets to go ahead and say, yeah, I've got this request for a ship. Here it is. Let's go and do. And so we went and did, and we maintained these presence. The COCOM sort of identified these 18 maritime regions of the world where we had defined national interest, and we began to send ships there on a regular basis. And during the Cold War, the average number of ships that were at sea at any given moment was around 150 ships. You can actually look at that through looking at our exercise and historical records. And it was fine. If you had 600 ships, it was okay to have 150 ships at sea because, you know, you had 25 ships in workups, you had 25 ships that were doing maintenance, deep maintenance, you had ships that were in the middle of crew training. You had enough room in your schedule that you could keep 150 ships at sea. But when the size of the fleet falls below 600, when it crashes through 450 ships in the early 90s, when it goes through 400 or 350 by, I think it's 1997, we go through 300 in 2003, and we get down to 271 in 2015. And suddenly, those presence requirements haven't gone away. Because we've defined those as national interests, if you don't go and service those national interests, then you create a vacuum that invites others to go and fill that. And by the way, that whole time that we had that large Navy, we were also lulling our allies and partners into thinking that they did not have to have large navies because the United States was sufficient to cover down on everyone's interests. And so they had a shrinkage of their fleets that kept up and even was greater than ours after the Cold War. So you look at where we're at today. Now, if we had allowed our presence missions to shrink in line with the size of our fleet, then we would only have about 75 ships at sea today. You figure a 300-ship Navy and you divide, you know, in quarters, it would be around 75 ships. But the fact is we're keeping around 108 to 115 ships forward deployed at any given moment to try and uphold 150 ships worth of presence requirements. That means that those 112 ships are perhaps not dwelling as long in some of these theaters and areas of interest as what we would like. They're simply passing through them, kind of like a cruiser with police officers moving through a neighborhood rather than getting out and walking around. And so you have sort of that shrinking of presence, but at the same time, it also is, again, creating this crumbling atmosphere. And it's also causing our fleet to crumble because when you're keeping 110 to 112 ships forward deployed, when you're only supposed to be doing 75, what is that doing to your training period? What is it doing to your maintenance period? It's shrinking them as well. And I think if you look at 2017 and the three collisions and the grounding of that year, then you realize that this is part of that drawdown pressure that we put on the fleet.
Yeah, I thought your point about, and it is startling when you look at, because whether you're facing the, you know, global communism or not, the globe's the same size. your yep. important coastal areas and sea line of communications are the same. And, you know, it seems in some ways that there are a few hangovers from the Cold War that here we are 30 years later that we're still, you know, starting to work through. For instance, I know you and I both did at the end of the 1990s, which most people call the post-Cold War area before 9/11, plus or minus a couple of years, you and I both did a battle group deployment. And it used to be, now that we call it a strike group, because that's less hostile, I guess. Anyway, a carrier battle group at that time, you had your carrier. You had two cruisers. You had two DDGs. You had two DDs. You had two FFGs. You had a, you know, big old replenishment ship with you. You had a couple of submarines. I think I mentioned the frigates as well. It was big and it was substantial. That has the modern iteration of that is but a shadow. But while we have degraded from that, I also liked how you mentioned in the book that another part of that Cold War period has affected the Chinese. Is they saw what we did in the Balkans, and we saw what we did off of Taiwan. And just talk for a minute about how that post-Cold War period, as you and I define it, how that impacted the direction the Chinese Navy we see today has shaped itself.
Well, and this is a critical point that I make within the book is the fact that, I mean, almost immediately after the Cold War ends, you know, young men like you and I, we're off to Desert Shield, Desert Storm. And you know, we roll in there, you know, we build up 540,000 ground troops in Saudi Arabia. We do the big left hook. We pile the Navy in. You know, you got four carriers, you know, operating and doing missions. You know, we just flood the area. And we're given the time. We build up over 6 months from the time, I think it's August, that I was sitting, you know, at a pool in Jacksonville, Florida, when the invasion of Kuwait occurs. And then we do Desert Shield essentially starting in December, and then Storm begins about a month and a half later after the air campaign. And we have that time to sort of build up, and then we execute. And then you sort of flash forward a few years, and we have the Taiwan Strait incident, where China is trying to influence an election that's going on in Taiwan, where the nationalists or independence movement people are trying to, you know, surge to the front of leadership. So the Chinese shell down a few missiles north of the island, and President Clinton decides he's going to send a carrier strike group as well as a light amphibious carrier through the Strait of Taiwan. To try and send a signal, and it really does send a signal. I mean, it is a huge brushback pitch that is taken in just that way. And then we go into Kosovo, and we have yet another sort of long, campaign where we're doing a regime change campaign in former Yugoslavia. During that campaign, one of our B-2 bombers actually drops a precision strike weapon onto the Chinese embassy. Which they don't regard as an accident. We say it's an accident, and they don't believe us. But what they see is that there's a couple things that the Americans do that they don't like. One is that, the Americans will build up and they will execute a regime change. If Americans tell you that they're coming to change regimes, chances are they're coming to change regimes. So the Chinese and the Russians both notice this. The Russians, by the way, you remember this well, are really put off by the fact they weighed in strong about us going into Yugoslavia. They told us that this was their sphere, this was a Slavic issue, and that we needed to stay out of it. They put a lot of credibility on the line, and we ignored that, and we rolled in there and did what we and the rest of our NATO allies wanted to do. And so they recognized that the Americans and the West were not going to pay attention to their opinions, and that if you give them enough time to build up in the area, they will come in and change things. And so they made a decision. We are not going to allow the Americans in the West to roll in. We are not going to give them access. They will not be able to get close to us. And so they, by the mid-1990s, begin to invest in these new capabilities, which we now call anti-access air denial. And their main thing is, I'm going to extend an umbrella of defensive capability from my shore over the oceans, and I'm going to push back the Americans beyond the range of what their weapons can reach. And lo and behold, we played into their hands. I always say that the world zigged and we zagged, because just as the Chinese and the Russians are starting to build these things, we're cutting all the range off from the decks of our aircraft carriers and out of our carrier air wings. And so we arrive essentially in the early 2000s, and they're building these missiles, which we don't know about yet, or at least we don't know about publicly. But at the same time, we've gone from a long-range flight deck to a medium to short-range flight deck by going sort of with an all-Boeing Hornet deck. And that's a problem, because as we arrive here today, they have the ability, or at least they believe they have the ability, to push us back, and we don't have the ability to push and actually go ashore. And so they, at that same time, begin to build this intellectual argument. And this is the thing that really intrigued me as the more I thought about it, is this idea of pushing territorial claims over the oceans. The Russians push north into the Arctic, and then the Chinese push into the South China Sea, but also into the East China Sea, where they're making some claims there vis-a-vis the Japanese. And just saying, hey, we have historic claims over this, and we can protect those claims. We have the weapons that we will force our rules upon you. Well, the problem with that for the United States is that we are a global superpower, and we present ourselves as a global superpower. And that sort of castle that we built in the air about being able to be all things to all people at all places at all times, that castle disappears if those two powers are able to create a regional sphere of influence. If the Chinese can demonstrate, I can build a sphere of influence just off my shores, and the Russians can do it in the Arctic, and the Americans can do nothing about it, then the promise of American global hegemony or ability to be the world's policeman, that promise vaporizes. It goes away, and everyone realizes, I'll shift my comparison. Everyone then realizes we truly are the emperor with no clothes. And that's what my concern is now, is that by allowing our Navy to fall so that we can no longer uphold these rules and norms, we are revealing ourselves in all our humility.
Well, if the Navy we have doesn't meet the requirement that you've identified, what will the Navy of the future need to look like?
So I get to this in the back, because after you sort of build the argument that, hey, you need a larger Navy and you need a Navy to be able to service these 18 maritime regions and be all these places. So what does that Navy look like? I've said for years that 355 is a good start, but it represents the minimal requirement to provide service of those 355. There's no spare space there once you're at 355. So what is it really? It's interesting because there's a lot of different numbers floating around, and I mentioned a couple there in the book. One, CNO Greenert, one time up in front of the House Armed Services Committee, made the statement that if someone asks him and says, what's the real number? And he came up and says, the real number would be around 450. So we have that on the record. Congressman Banks of Indiana, with his Five Ocean Navy Act a couple of years ago, made mention that we needed around 436 ships, I think, was Congressman Banks' number. And he runs those calculations internally as well. We have the administration now, which they've come out with their numbers since I've actually sent the book to press, but they've laid down a requirement for 400 ships, which they think that they can get to 355 in 10 years, and 400 by essentially the end of the 2030s, and then, essentially be steady state after that. So they've laid down a requirement at around 400. I've actually gone through and essentially looked at all of our requirements, like the 11 aircraft carrier requirement, and then looked at how many ships it takes to protect those, and then how many ships it require to do presence operations, because there is a balance in the fleet. You have a balance between your war-winning capabilities and then your peace-preserving capabilities. And so when I added that all up, and it's actually at the end of the book, right at the very end, and I do a comparison between the Navy of today and the Navy of 2040. And I, you know, today we're at 295, and I believe that the fleet we need is 456 ships.
Well, with that larger number, Jerry, and there's something that, you know, I know we've talked about here on the show before, and it's, you know, you just got to keep talking about it. You got to keep talking about it. And speaking of things that go back to the 1990s, people a lot smarter and with better vision than I have, I remember them screaming about it, and here we are. But if we have a national requirement to grow a Navy like that, to that size, to 456, with that, you have to have an industrial capacity and a skilled workforce to be able to create that fleet. And if you need it by 2040, you need to be cutting steel inside of two palm cycles. It's not something we can wait to do till 2030 to get going. And to do that, you need actual facilities. You need shipyards, not just to build them, but as has become very apparent and has broken into the open finally, especially in the last 12 months, we do not have the ability to properly maintain the fleet we have. Part of that's related to op tempo, of course. But, you know, what are some of the things that we can do to build that industrial and human capital capacity? And, you know, if you got some ideas to do it, but it has some secondary and tertiary effects to our national economy and, you know,
yeah,
really the quality of life for a lot of people. Because you if you are a qualified welder at a shipyard, you're making some pretty good cheese.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things to understand, our ships are expensive to build, and they're expensive for a couple different reasons. One, our ships are high tech. They've got a lot of survivability built into them. There's a lot of requirements that are foisted upon the shipbuilders by Naval Sea Systems Command as we generate our designs. But they're also expensive to build because we have a very limited industrial base to build ships. And the competition within that base, I mean, we have 2 yards that build destroyers. We have 2 yards that build submarines. We have 1 yard that builds supercarriers. And so the competition level that exists is not large. You know, during World War II, we had over 50 shipyards in the United States that were building everything. So between Liberty ships to destroyers to aircraft carriers, there were over 50 yards that had graving docks greater than 500 feet in length, which those graving docks were strategic assets. We recognized it at the time. I can build more ships if I have graving docks, but if I don't have graving docks, I can't build ships. So what's more important? It's the graving dock. And today we have a very limited supply of graving docks in the United States and shipbuilding yards. So how do you get this price of your Navy to go down? Well, you get that by actually growing your civilian merchant shipbuilding infrastructure. How do you grow your merchant shipbuilding infrastructure? You buy more ships. Why do we need more ships? Well, we are now becoming an energy export country. We, over the last 4 years, have seen a significant increase in manufacturing in the United States, some of which is beginning to go overseas as American manufacturers are once again competing with other nations. Does it mean that we have the lowest priced labor market? No, we don't. But we're also starting to recognize how others are beginning to take advantage of their labor, and we're beginning to penalize that in some of our trade deals. So the fact here is that if you actually made a requirement that says, hey, look, the United States is starting to export oil and liquefied natural gas, and that a certain percentage of that exported energy has to go on American hulls, well, now I incentivize the building of ships in the United States, commercial, civilian ships. Same thing with other manufacturing. Once you start encouraging that to come back into the American economy, one, you reactivate a supplier base. We have, in some cases, there are some aspects of what we build for the United States Navy today that are built or supplied by only one supplier. That's a mighty thin reed to lean on in a time of war. You need to grow that. You need to have a diverse supply of manufacturers who are bringing component parts into your Navy yard, you can do that by also growing your civilian yard. And I get into this about the idea of the United States stepping back in to actively manage that aspect of its economy. And for those who say, well, this is America, the world of free enterprise, and you're making a conversation about free navigation and free trade, and yet you're talking about sort of a centrally controlled economy, at least on this. The fact of the matter is when you're in great power competitions, you do this. I've got a number of great books on my shelf that talk about how we managed the building of the United States Navy from, you know, a couple hundred ships to 6,000 ships during World War II. That didn't all ride on the back of, you know, free trade and free enterprise. The government stepped in and made some decision, made some puts and takes on what has to come and what has to go. And I think that there's a role to be played by, you know, sort of the central government in looking at this under the defense industrial base sort of control aspects. So I call for this within this, that we need to look at this, mostly because, again, it comes back to, are you in a great power competition, yes or no? Yes. Do you want to win, yes or no? Well, yes. Okay, well, here's what you're going to do that. And we've made those hard choices in the past, and I think it's time to step up and make them again.
It's an interesting issue. Many years ago, I was getting a master's degree, and there was one of the instructors had we worked for a government agency. Its function was to choose industries, not to choose, but to know about industries that were vital to the national defense. And one of those, I believe, would be merchant shipbuilding, capable of handling the one of the reasons that we haven't done merchant shipbuilding much in the U.S. is that the requirements for large ships to carry containers or these large supertankers, we don't have any place to put them. But, you know, that kind of facility that could build one of those would be useful in building, things like aircraft carriers and other large ships. I think that's vital. The other question is, I mean, you put down, I think in your book, you had 90 support vessels as part of the size of the fleet. Are you talking about auxiliaries, AEs, AOs, AOEs, all that stuff?
Well, I mean, yes, it is those because, you know, one of the things that you look at and you start pulling the string on, you know, if you look at the size of the auxiliary fleet, the logistics support fleet over time, you know, when the United States was keeping, you know, four or five aircraft carriers forward deployed simultaneously, it takes a lot of ships to keep oil and butter and beans and ammunition flowing out to those ships. If you actually are thinking about prosecuting a wartime campaign in the Pacific and you are trying to resupply multiple carrier strike groups or, for that matter, other types of surface action groups, and, by the way, keep supplies flowing to Air Force squadrons that are operating on places like Guam, Tinian, and Saipan, then that's a lot of supply ships, and we don't have them today. We've allowed that aspect of our Navy to sort of degrade away. It's been attrited over time, and we haven't made the investment. If we get an extra dollar, I'm going to buy another destroyer, has been the way that we've looked at that, and there's an argument to be made that, yes, I need the destroyers, I need my combatants. But in great power competition, you're going to need your logistics force. So you're right. If you look at that final list where I talk about 456 ships, a lot of those ships are in that last column towards the bottom, which is the battle of the fleet support ships, and there's 90 of them there. Presently here today, we need 55. You start talking about taking your fleet from 300 to 450-plus, then you need to grow that logistics at least by that much. There's an argument that says that we're behind right now, and in fact the growth in that area should be more. Now, here's the other point. I have more capacity in that type of shipbuilding today in the United States than I actually do in building combatants. If I was to go to my two major destroyer yards right now and told them to double that tomorrow, they're going to have a difficult time doing that. They don't have much excess capacity with regard to both space within their yards as well as the manpower, welders and pipe fitters and everything else. So if I want to do that, I have some additional capacity to build logistics ships. You look at Philly and what Acre's doing up in Philly with the two big dry docks we've got there. You know, I could start, you know, lining things up there and building there that I'm underutilizing that asset. There are other docks, you know, up on the West Coast that I'm not getting full use out of. The point here is start finding where you have excess capacity in your yards right now and start applying dollars there. There's other places, by the way. During World War II, we built a lot of amphibious capabilities and smaller ships on the Mississippi, the Ohio, and on the Great Lakes. Look everywhere for where you have excess capacity and build. We can ramp up our big destroyer and combatant yards over time, but right now I have excess capacity for small ships and logistics ships, so that's where I should probably start growth at this point.
Yeah, I think of that that little outline of your 2040 fleet towards the end of the book. That's exactly the line that caught my attention. Firmly in the unsexy but important category, and we've really made compound mistakes in these areas. And you know, a lot of it, I think, it comes from the fact that, you know, again, another point you make in the book that's important for people to have in the back of their mind is we have been relatively unchallenged at sea since the Second World War, except for a brief period where the Soviet Union surged forward in the 70s through 89. And in 1989, you and I were ensigns. Maybe we're standing there getting our JGs strapped on at that point. But there's nobody under age 55, really, that got more than one deployment when we were somewhat challenged at sea. And along with logistics ships and other things that are unsexy but important, you know, we've got to look at the Arctic. And besides short-sighted budgetary reasons, why do you think, especially us as an Arctic nation, that whether you're talking about ice-hardened ships or something as fundamental as icebreakers, we seem to have forgotten and, in a way, to use a hard phrase, abandoned the Arctic, while Russia and China in the last few decades have gone from strength and capability to strength and capability. You know, enough about, we know why they think it's important, but where does our lack of vision come from?
Well, let me back up for a second and then come back to the Arctic, because you mentioned something that we sort of skipped over earlier, which is the last 70 years. And what has the last 70 years really been about? I mean, how does it manifest? How do we know that the last 70 years is different than the preceding 400 years? And that's an argument I actually make in the front third of the book, where I actually begin to examine the number of naval battles over time. And so let me just briefly say that I kind of begin mapping the number of instances of conflict and wars and battles on the sea with the English and Dutch in the 1600s, and then I bring that forward looking at instances, you know, sort of on a decade-by-decade, century-by-century look. And then you have this sort of stunning disappearance of war at sea after World War II. And that's part of the hypothesis, that it's the United States' overwhelming awe, its ability, the size and the capacity and the capabilities of the American fleet is what sort of drives conflict from the world's oceans. And it's only, I mean, there's a couple instances that occur, obviously the Falklands conflict, obviously our 1987 incident with the Iranians, you know, so there are, I'm not saying that it went only totally peaceful, but the fact is it's the sheer size and capabilities of the American fleet and its rule set. Everyone knows the Americans are not going to come and conquer your territory and move in and take over. That's just not the way that we've operated. Even those places that we've seized, you know, we gave Cuba back. The Philippines were granted independence some 40 years later. Hawaii decided to stay, et cetera. But the fact is we're not sort of the, hey, I'm here to conquer you, you know, type of place. So that's sort of what I saw here is that, but this is coming to an end. This is my hypothesis, that as we shrink, it's the fact that we got below 300 that actually encouraged the Chinese to hit the accelerator and say, now they're weak, now they're distracted, now's the time to go. We will make our move upon the world's oceans now because the Americans are not there. So that's that part. Now let's shift to the Arctic. we had ice hardened ice rated ships during World War II, because a great number of the campaigns were occurring up near Alaska, and we saw that the competition could go north. The ice was thicker during that period of time, as we were sort of in the ice age, and now that we're in global warming and the ice begins to thin, and things like the Northwestern Passage and the Northern Sea Route are beginning to open earlier and earlier, and you're starting to see more transit up there, and there's a lot more resources up there, so oil, natural gas, also food supplies. As the world's ocean temperatures have shifted, you know, the fishing stocks tend to move towards cooler waters, and so the Chinese, this is one of the reasons that they're paying more attention up north. It's not just the good energy coming out of northern Russia, it's also the fact that food supplies are going up there as well. And so we're seeing this competition, but the United States has been caught at sort of this moment of being flat-footed. When we started to realize what was happening, we did not have the strategic wherewithal to begin investing in ships that could go north. We've allowed our icebreaker fleet to get down to about 1.5 icebreakers, where we have one heavy icebreaker, and we have another heavy that we sort of use as a parts locker. We have one medium icebreaker, the Healy, that just had a breakdown, and we're sort of replacing the engine there. So we've had no ability to compete with Russia in the far north. And so this is one of the things. We are building new heavy icebreakers now, three of them, but those icebreakers are really focused on Antarctica and our treaty obligations and our scientific obligations down there. We don't have the medium icebreaker fleet that we need to go north, nor does the United States Navy have surface combatants that can go north and operate up there as well. They don't have the thicker steel. They don't have the closer spacing on the ribs to be able to go up there and be robust. Also, our submarine fleet, which has been a big part of our Arctic, that part of our submarine fleet, which is a Los Angeles class improved and the three Seawolves, that population is decreasing as the LA improved are being decommed. And the Virginias were not built to be ice hardened. They are not built to go in the same places that the Los Angeleses and the Seawolves are. So that's an issue that we have to address. The Coast Guard can do some things, but the Coast Guard's not military. It's law enforcement. You know, if the U.S. military is going to protect interest in the far north, then the United States Navy has to step forward and have a ship that can provide that type of security patrol and provide presence in the Arctic region. And that is an area of competition. Russia has made it clear by having 40 icebreakers, 9 heavy nuclear, and they actually up-arming at least 6 icebreakers at this point in time with missiles that can operate in that far north. We don't have things that can do that up there, and that's going to be a problem for us within the next 10 years.
Well, that's a charming outlook, isn't it? General Miley was on a board or on a U.S. Naval Institute defense virtual conference the other day, and he kind of threw a nice bone at the Navy. The fundamental defense of the United States and the ability to project power forward will always be and for American naval and air and space power.
Yes,
I mean. Those are nice things, and I understand that there is some discussion about reducing the. I don't know how they're going to do this without some change in the law, but reduce the amount of money the Army gets and putting that money toward the Navy and I guess the Air Force and the space whatever there are now Space Command.
Yeah. No, I mean
how good
true.
Is that?
The administration's just come out with its 400 ship Navy proposal. And the White House actually released information where they're calling for a reduction in Army end strength. So you have the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, who is an Army general, who is a former chief of staff of the Army, who's come out and said, hey, look, the Army needs to take a haircut because we need to emphasize the Navy and also the Air Force in this competition in the Western Pacific. And then the administration, and I recognize it's kind of a parting shot, but let's face it, 355 ships was the Obama administration's parting shot when it departed in 2016, and we've all treated that almost as if it was sacrosanct over the last 4 years. So this 400-ship Navy plan that the Trump administration has announced, which I think has had a lot of good thought that goes into it, you know, part of it is reducing Army end strength. It's right there, big, bold letters on their handout where they're talking about taking the Army down as well as its reserve component, and trying to take at least $2.6 billion in savings to funnel into the Navy over the next few years. So it's there, and I think that those are the types of puts and takes that have to be done. It's difficult because in a flat budget environment, which is what we're expecting, which I think is unfortunate. I think DOD's budget should continue to grow. But in a flat budget, that means that you have to prioritize. And I think in that priority, the Army goes down, the Navy goes up. You know, we did this before. In the Cold War, in the 1954 through 1957 defense budgets, the Air Force got 49% of DOD spending. The Navy got 29%, and the Army got like 18, 19%. That was the priority that we placed in that competition. We're in another great power competition now, and it's time to sort of break the china of Goldwater Nichols and actually begin reprioritizing as to what's going to work for us in this new competition.
And, you know, I think part of that argument is, though I guess in polite society you're not supposed to say the C word, China, but, you know, let's look at that primary competitor we have. And, you know, you outline three drivers of trade in there that had me thinking, you know, when you look at China's ultimate motivation, which is to keep 1.2, 1.3 billion people from rioting, you've got to keep them fed, you've got to keep them relatively happy, you've got to keep them warm in winter, and some of them are getting spoiled down south and getting air conditioners, so cool in summer. That requires food, that requires fuel.
Yeah.
China has that huge merchant fleet. It uses the belt, i.e. the sea lines of communication. And those three drivers of trade that let a medium income on a per capita basis, which is China, on a per capita basis, those three things become three critical vulnerabilities that most military people will tilt their head at. You're looking at price, reliability, and security. And nothing can threaten or adjust those needles more than power at sea.
Yeah, so, I mean, you look at it, there's a reason why China is terrified about the United States Navy and the world's oceans. One, they have no, let's put it this way, they have limited amounts of natural resources in their nation. They are dependent upon raw resources, be it ores or energy, from overseas. The belt can supply what the road is incapable of. You just simply cannot transport enough materials by pipelines or by rail to get it into the Chinese economy and keep it going. So therefore, they need supplies to come out of the Middle East for energy, ores and raw materials out of Africa and Australia and South America. I mean, there's an entire 400,000-ton type of ship that's an ore carrier that they call China Max, or Valex ships that are there to supply ores to the Chinese economy. So they're dependent on those raw resources. On the other side, the Chinese economy, they don't have a middle class that can consume the goods that they're manufacturing. Their advantage now is cheap labor. Their disadvantage is their people can't buy the stuff they're producing, and so they're entirely dependent on export markets. When the Trump administration began the trade wars, where we stopped buying things, you know, China sort of had a heart attack at that point in time. They now recognize that the world recognizes that we know the two crucial vulnerabilities they have. We can cut off their supplies of raw materials. We can also turn off the market to which they absolutely need to sell stuff. There's not enough markets in the world to buy what they're selling unless the United States and the West, you know, comes on board. And then the other point is the ideas of freedom, free trade. You look at what's wrong with Hong Kong in the Chinese eyes, it's those wild ideas about freedom that circulate around Hong Kong. And the very nature of Taiwan as a free nation with free enterprise and capitalism, that terrifies the Chinese, that it's run amok. So the sea is the conveyor of all of these threats to the Chinese people, which is why they have to gain control over it.
Yeah, I want to go back to an earlier question. This kind of has to do with your long-ago article called Ford, Not Ferraris. And I want to talk a little bit about how we grow the fleet that makes sense, because, you know, super carriers, given the threat that against them, may not be the most useful tool in the toolbox right now, although they are quite useful. What should the fleet look like? Well, I mean, are we going to many smaller carriers, many smaller ships? As Wayne Hughes kept pointing out, war is usually fought in the inshore environment and nearshore environment, not out in the big blue water.
So I agree, and it's kind of interesting because, you know, you've got your carrier strike groups, and we're required by law to maintain 11 carriers in the fleet. The question is how we're going to define those carriers going forward. So when you have carrier strike groups and you have the, you know, two cruisers, four destroyers, a couple frigates, and then the fast attack submarines that generally go with them for them to be really combat effective. And so let's put that over on one side. Let's call that part of my winning the war force. I also group into that for now the four SSGN Ohio guided missile submarines with their 155 VLS tubes to launch Tomahawks. And for that matter, other types of missiles that we can bring in the future, then they're part of that war-winning capability as well. But what about my Preserve the Peace Force? And that's sort of where the Influence Squadron from the Buy Fords, Not Ferraris article from, like, I think it's 2008 or 2009, that's where that draws from. This is where we're out there maintaining presence in the rule sets and the norms. And so I would center around the new frigate, the Constellation class FFG 62 ships that are coming out, and also the large unmanned and medium unmanned platforms that can extend the range of those ships and also deepen their magazines. So you put sensor unmanned out there to increase that range. Maybe they operate all as well with the littoral combat ships that are at sea and operating at this time. And then they also operate in conjunction with motherships like the ships that are being built in San Diego that can come out TAKEs and do resupply of parts and energy and so on to keep them at sea longer. Those are the ships that you can purchase. I remember in, I think, 2009, I did another article like More Henderson, Less Bonds, where I looked at how much I could buy for the cost of one Arleigh Burke-class destroyer, which I priced at that time at 2.2. Now, the Burks have come down to 1.85 now. But the fact is for $2.2 billion, you can buy at least one Constellation class. You could buy probably one LCS, and then you could buy a resupply ship and a bunch of small unmanned and still come in, you know, at less than $2 billion. There's a lot that you can do for very little so far as growing your presence and then having them work cooperatively together out there. And then those present ships have a role to play in wartime as well. It's not like they go away. You can push them farther back to main blockade, do them scout and sensor to try and find the enemy fleets. The fact is it all comes together. It's just that we need to recognize the balance and sort of create the conditions where I sort of deter the enemy, an enemy who wants to go to war with me, by convincing them today's not the day. Because I know where you're at, I know what you're doing, I know what you're thinking, and I'm always going to do something you can't predict I'm going to do. Because why? Because I'm an American, and I may write books about doctrine and dogma, I just never follow them. And that's sort of part of the way Americans operate at sea.
on that very patriotic note, because it's true, Jerry, it's been a great hour to spend with you to talk about your book. And again, for the listeners, it's titled To Provide and Maintain a Navy, Why Naval Primacy is America's First Best Strategy. And Jerry, for the listeners, that they're gnawing at the bit to get this book in their hot little hands, when will it be available for general purchase?
So we are working on finalizing the book design and cover and everything, and we're hoping to have it out within the next couple weeks. Of course, I want it out prior to Christmas, but as soon as we do, I will reach out to you and Eagle One, as well as everyone else in the naval community via Twitter or email or whatever means I can, and start sending the hot link with regard to the Amazon site or other sites where it might be available. But we want to get it. I want it to look professional. This is one I hope sticks around on people's shelves for a while that they can go back and thumb. And so I'm working with a great publisher, and I'm hoping to get it out soon.
Well, it's an excellent read, and it's an excellent read. I hope everybody gets a copy of it because it's a good argument for why we need a strong Navy.
Well, I hope that you tell that to all your friends.
And Jerry will definitely be best to trumpet it. And I hope that you and yours have a great Christmas and look forward to the next opportunity to talk.
And Merry Christmas to you both as well. Thank you.
Thank you.
And thank you very much, everybody, for joining us for another edition of MidRats. Until next time, I hope everybody has a great Navy Day. Cheers.
Maloney wants to marry me, and so leave the Strand and Piccadilly, or you'll be to blame. For love has fairly drove me silly, hoping you're the same.
It's a long way to Tipperary, it's a long way to go, it's a long way to Tipperary. It's a long, long way to Tipperary.